It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn how farms are meeting the forest to create more sustainable agriculture.
First, there's been a flurry of activity and news surrounding the ongoing investigations into whether Russia interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The chairman of the House committee that's investigating has been accused of getting intelligence info from the White House staffers, then sharing that info with the president.
Meanwhile, the Senate has begun its own investigation, and former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn has said that he'll testify before Congress if he's given immunity from prosecution.
Karen Demirjian joins us now. She covers defense and foreign policy for the Washington Post. She was previously a correspondent based in the Post Bureau in Moscow. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, so much is going on in this ongoing story of Russia investigations. Right now, before we get into some of the most recent events, what are you watching for next?
Well, the most intriguing development is that we've heard this offer that has been made to congressional investigators, at least on the Senate side, from the lawyers of the former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, in exchange for immunity. And we've seen the president tweeting about that this morning as well. That certainly is raising all kinds of questions about what is it that he wants to talk about. Is he wanting the immunity because there is something much bigger there? Maybe he's going to divulge some sort of, you know, smoking gun that would implicate him as well? Or is it, as the president alleges, that, you know, they just don't trust the investigations to proceed as a not, quote, witch hunt, which is what the administration has been using to describe these investigations on and off. That is the latest development, and that is the most mysterious and unanswered one right now. We're also at the same time trying to iron out exactly what led to the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, and how he procured this information about from a source that indicated to him that the president's name potentially, or maybe his surrogate's name, revealed on these surveillance reports were focused on foreign targets. We reported this morning that there were three White House officials involved in getting him those documents. So this raises questions of whether there is coordination between the White House and the committees that are supposed to be investigating the White House and potential links to Russian officials. So it's like with every passing day and sometimes with every passing half day, there is an added element of intrigue or mystery or suspicion or connections that seem suspect. And each time we get one of those, we still are in the process of trying to unpack and see if these dots actually in a concrete way that reveals something's going on.
Let's dig into those a little bit more. Now, Michael Flynn, of course, there's talk that he's looking for immunity. Some legal experts have pointed out that doesn't necessarily mean, when you ask for immunity, that doesn't mean you've committed a crime. But then media outlets have been going back to some Michael Flynn quotes from 2016. Here's one where he's talking about the Hillary Clinton campaign and requests for immunity there.
The very last thing that John Podesta just said is no individual too big to jail. That should include people like Hillary Clinton. I mean, five people around her have been given immunity, to include her former chief of staff. When you are given immunity, that means that you've probably committed a crime.
A bit awkward now that he's looking for immunity, him saying, when you ask for immunity, you've probably committed a crime. Is that how people in Washington are reading this now?
Indeed. I mean, there's certainly, you know, if you've said that yourself and that is your governing philosophy, then you need to know that if you haven't committed a crime and you ask for immunity, you're probably sticking your foot very far into your mouth. But, there is certainly a lot of suspicion swirling around Washington about does he have something that would implicate himself, that would potentially lead to him being criminally prosecuted even. Is that why he's seeking this immunity? Of course, the administration, no, but at this point, he has not testified. I don't actually believe that his offer to test exchange for immunity has been accepted. So it is certainly raising a whole bunch of questions, as I said, about what does he know? What does he know about others, including himself? What is he going to say? What does he want to say? Or is this just a way of basically of confusing the process even more?
We're talking to Karen Demirjian from The Washington Post, looking at the ongoing story, a lot of different elements here in the investigation into Russian interference in the American election, what's going on with Michael Flynn, House and Senate investigations. And Karen, let's turn to the House now. And you mentioned earlier Devin Nunes and that he'd apparently gotten this information from, you said, three White House staffers. Who in the White House was giving him this information?
Well, what we have reported is that there was one of the, I believe it was a top lawyer for the National Security Council, was involved in the passage of this information onto Nunes. And so were two other officials that are involved with the White House national security apparatus, one of whom had ties to Nunes from before, and another one of whom whose name may have come up if you've seen earlier in the press, because there was a little bit of a arm wrestling match between H.R. McMaster, the current national security advisor, and the administration when he came in about what role this person would play. So those are three people who are, you know, pretty serious figures in the White House that have been that has now been reported as having been involved in this whole process. And then the question is, you know, okay, so does that mean that there has been coordination? Is this just happened to be, you know, coincidence that that's what happened? Or is there something to hide here? And the fact that we seem to be figuring out the information about how these documents were transferred to Nunes bit by bit by bit by bit. First, it was just a source he wouldn't identify. Then he said he went to the White House grounds. Now we have reports saying that there are actually White House officials that were involved in this. And, of course, his office is not – well, his office did tell us publicly about the trip to the White House grounds, but they have not been saying, oh, well, okay, that's all correct at every step of the way. And so, you know, at this point, do we have the whole story, or does it go beyond that? Is there some? Is this just a one-off that it happened this way, or is this evidence of some sort of greater coordination between the White House and the head of the Intelligence Committee? And that question is one that Democrats are asking very, very, very loudly. But it is important to establish that even if there is, you know, a political relationship, Nunes served on Trump's transition team, that there is not a relationship of collaboration there, because you do have the House Intelligence Committee committed to investigate. Part of what they've said they are looking into is any ties between the presidential campaigns and the Kremlin officials, and that includes the sitting president and his team and his campaign team. So that is a potentially troubling thing if he's talking to them before he's talking to his committee. Now, the one distinguishing element in that may be that Nunes has said this has nothing to do with Russia. He said that from the first day when he talked about these documents. Okay, well, if it has nothing to do with Russia and it's completely separate and apart from the procedure of the Russia investigation, then it still begs the question of why this was brought up at this time in such a public forum, and why there isn't more of either transparency about what happened and how he came by these documents, or just direct alerting going on. Why did the officials from the White House come to Nunes first before they then went to the president? It doesn't have to happen that way.
Are people taking the House investigation seriously anymore, or are there a lot of questions being raised about whether this is a valid investigation?
Well, it depends on which party you're in. I think that Republicans in the House are certainly, you know, rallying around the chairman and saying they did everything right here, but you have not all Republicans doing that. You've got one or two House Republicans that have said, you know what, at this point the Senate has to at least take the lead because it's such a mess. In the Senate, you have, you know, other people looking at Nunes and Republicans saying, okay, that's not confidence-inspiring, or John McCain saying we're going to need a select committee or an independent commission because Congress can't be trusted to do this on its own. And you have other Republicans just, you know, when I'd ask them, what do you think, just be like, I'm not touching that, no. So, I think there is a lot. There's certainly been a very, very stark difference between what happened in the last week or two in the House versus in the Senate's Intelligence Committee. You have in the House open sniping, accusations of collusion, all kinds of signs of a massive cataclysmic, potentially fatal breakdown for this Russia investigation on the House side. Whereas on the Senate side, you have the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee putting his arm around the top Republican and saying, I trust this guy. We're going to work together with our committee members. We're going to get to the bottom of this. Rah, rah. We're in this in the good old-fashioned bipartisan fight.
Let's give a listen to Senator Richard Burr, North Carolina Republican, his opening remarks in this committee investigation. I don't know if anybody has an arm around him at this point. Let's give a listen.
The Vice Chairman and I realize that if we politicize this process, our efforts will likely fail. The public deserves to hear the truth about possible Russian involvement in our elections, how they came to be involved, how we may have failed to prevent that involvement, what actions were taken in response, if any, and what we plan to do to ensure the integrity of future free elections at the heart of our democracy.
And are people viewing this Senate investigation, Karan, with more confidence than the House side?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you have people on both sides of the aisle speaking highly about the leaders on the other side of the aisle, and you really do have a lot of faith in the process. And I think that many people have asked me over the last week, now that all of this has been happening, to discredit the House Intelligence Committee's impartiality in this investigation, do you think that there will actually be, a special committee or an independent commission? And I've been saying, probably not, both because Republicans in the House are still backing Nunes and its chairmanship and its ability to run this investigation, and because doing so would probably take the ball out of the Senate Intelligence Committee's hands, and they haven't done anything yet to deserve being, chastised in that regard or elbowed aside, really, because people do trust their conducting this process in the right way. They are launching in on a series of interviews starting next week that will focus on people that they, 20 people, they haven't scheduled absolutely every last one of them, but they believe they're about to, 20 different people that they've requested to interview, most of them people that were behind that intelligence community assessment that came out at the beginning of the year that found that Russia did in fact intervene in the election with the goal of helping Trump's candidacy. They have also said that they will be probably talking to people who have volunteered themselves. And as we know, we're now, I think, up to 5 Trump team officials, if we include Flynn. And then there's Jared Kushner, Carter Page, Paul Manafort, and Roger Stone have all offered to be interviewed in different ways by the Senate Intelligence Committee. Also, I would say, though, that partly one of the reasons that no one has had cause potentially to start pointing and accusing finger at either side of the aisle and accusing them of playing politics is that they've done a lot of this behind closed doors. The House has done a lot more of it out in the open. All of these proceedings in the House Intelligence Committee really started to fall apart just a few days or a few hours, really, because I believe it was the next night that Nunes went to the White House to meet this source. But there was an open hearing the Monday before this past Monday, where they interviewed the FBI director and the NSA director, and you could hear in the questions that each side was trying to drive home a political point, and it didn't go as well for the Republicans as they had expected it would. And the next day, this trip to the White House happened, and the morning after that is when Nunes briefed the press and the president for his fellow members of the committee on these reports, these surveillance reports, and ever since then, things have just unraveled progressively. The Senate hasn't had to negotiate that sort of divide because the only public hearings that they've done in the last 2 months are yesterday's, which was not with intelligence community officials. It was with subject matter, cybersecurity, Russian influence peddling experts who aren't digging into this stuff in the intelligence community and thus don't have the secrets of whether or not there was collaboration between Trump team members and Russian officials. Eventually, if this starts to build up to a point where there is stuff there that their witnesses tell them, they have promised to hold some of those meetings, some of those hearings in public. But at this point, at this early stage, part of why they haven't really run around is that they haven't been playing it for the cameras as much as the House has been.
We'll leave it there for now until the next plot twist. Karan, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be with you.
Karan Demirjian covers defense and foreign policy for The Washington Post. She was previously a correspondent based in the Post Bureau in Moscow. She joined us for a look at the latest developments in the ongoing investigation into Russian meddling in the U.S. 2016 election. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Perrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we explore Japanese home cooking with an American who married into a Japanese family and earned her chops under the guidance of her mother-in-law.
First, when you say Wisconsin, a lot of people might think immediately of cows. We are the dairy state. But if you say the word silvopasture to someone, they may give you a confused look.
Diane Mayerfield joins us now. She's a UW Extension Specialist in Sustainable Agriculture, and her recent article on wiscontext.org looks at the agroforestry practice called silvopasture. Diane, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, starting out with terminology, what does it mean to when we say the word silvopasture? What is it?
Well, as you said, it's an agroforestry practice, and as you can hear in that word, it's a kind of agriculture that incorporates elements of forestry. And specifically, with silvopasture, it is the integrated management of trees, livestock, and forage, or the feed for the livestock.
And for the farmer involved, what is the benefit of using that integrated approach instead of doing what most farmers, I believe, commonly do, which is to use, you know, maybe a pasture, an open pasture?
Right. Well, there's a number of benefits. One of the main ones that farmers have talked about is the value of shade, especially in the particularly hot and humid days in the summer. Cattle are just as stressed or maybe even more stressed by heat and humidity as humans. And, of course, they don't have the ability to walk into an air-conditioned room in the same way that we people do. So that's one of the first things. And another thing is simply a lot of farmers who have woods on their property are interested in expanding the amount of pasture they have available, but maybe don't want to cut down all their trees to create open pasture.
And we've been talking about cattle, but is this just an option for cattle or other types of livestock?
Absolutely, other types of livestock can benefit too. Certainly sheep can, goats can. There are even a couple of farmers in Wisconsin who do silvopasture with bison. And you could use it for basically any livestock that uses pasture. I will say one reservation for that. People are very interested in potentially using silvopasture for pigs, but pigs are a particularly difficult animal because they love to root. So we're particularly worried about pigs and their impacts on trees.
Right, and that is one of the issues at stake when we talk about how to be successful when you use this technique of silvopasture. It sounds as though you have to be worried, for instance, about what kind of trees are there and also the kind of forage. What are some of the things that farmers need to look out for, at least make sure they have a plan for?
Well, one of the first things to mention is that there are two different ways to establish silvopasture, basically. One is if you already have woods, then you need to plant the forage in your woods. And probably one of the first things you need to do is make sure there's enough light for that forage to grow. If you have a completely closed canopy, if it's the kind of woods where you walk in and it's cool and dark, that's not going to support a layer of grass. So the first thing a farmer might have to do then is actually cut down some trees to make sure there's enough light coming in. If you plant trees in an open pasture, then obviously you already have your grass established. Then what you're worrying about is protecting the trees, the young trees, from your livestock and also from the competition that the grass provides.
Is there a particular type of tree that works well, a particular type of woods, too? Because I suppose you could have, you know, a copse of evergreen trees as an example, but you could also have deciduous trees.
That's a great question, and one to which we don't have a certain answer yet. We think that there are certain kinds of trees that are well adapted to silvopasture, in part based on what has been done in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. So that would include things like black walnut and oaks. But there are farmers who are making silvopasture work with other species as well. So some farmers are successfully doing silvopasture with maples, for instance, which wouldn't be the first thing we would recommend, but is, of course, a very common tree in Wisconsin. We think hickories might work, but we haven't done the research here yet.
Now, my sense is that in Wisconsin, silvopasture is not very common yet. Is that right?
That is right. The best statistics we have are from the agricultural census in 2012, and there were over 11,000 farms that reported pasturing their woods in that census, and only 109 farms that reported practicing either silvopasture or agroforestry. So there was one question that combined, or alley cropping, that combined those two agroforestry practices. But in other words, fewer than 1% of the farmers who graze their woods are consciously practicing silvopasture.
Are there, besides having some versatility when it comes to how you put your animals to pasture, are there also ecological benefits involved?
We think there absolutely are. And that statistic I just mentioned kind of points to one of them. When farmers just put cattle in the woods without actually consciously managing for the trees and for the forage, there's a lot of evidence that that can cause a lot of environmental damage. It can lead to soil compaction. It can lead to erosion. It can lead to impacts on tree health. And it might even, in some cases, lead to an increase in invasive species and brush that farmers don't want there. So those are all impacts that we are hoping proper silvopasture management can reduce. Another thing that some people are very interested in is using silvopasture as a technique to help reestablish savanna habitat. And savanna, which is basically grasslands but with scattered trees, was the primary habitat type before European settlement in southwestern Wisconsin. And now it's a habitat that's almost disappeared due to conversion of land use to farmland, and also due to fire suppression. And so people who are interested in restoring that very rare habitat type face some daunting challenges of controlling the invasion of trees and brush. And the primary tool has been fire, but of course that's dangerous and it's expensive. The hope is that we can also introduce grazing as a way to keep down competition from trees and brush in these systems. So there's some research going on that as well.
So Diana, as we wrap up, if there's a farmer out there listening who's interested in trying this method, is there a place that they can go to get more information about how to do it well?
There are a couple of places. There is a National Agroforestry Center, and they have some good information on silvopasture, but not specifically on the silvopasture in the Midwest. I have a listserv where I send out announcements about educational events, and people could contact me if they want to be added to that listserv. And for people who are able to travel to southwestern Wisconsin, there is a pasture walk coming up that's going to be sponsored by Crawford County that's going to look at one of the silvopasture research sites that we have going on.
Diane, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about it today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That was Diane Merrifield, a UW Extension Specialist in Sustainable Agriculture. We've been learning about silvopasture. For more on that topic, we've got a detailed article from WisConText linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll cook authentic home-style Japanese food. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll look at the biggest Wisconsin news from the past week, including the latest from the Budget Committee hearings.
First, Japanese food is delicious, but it can look difficult to make to home cooks like me. But it's not, says Amy Kaneko, an American who married into a Japanese family and spent 2 years living and cooking in Japan.
Kaneko relied on her mother-in-law, among others, to help share some of the techniques and tools of Japanese cooking, and now she's taking on the role of teacher.
Amy Kaneko joins us now. She's the author of the new cookbook, Let's Cook Japanese Food. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, what was it like when you moved to Japan, when you started cooking for your new family? What were some of the big adjustments you had to make coming from an American palate?
It is kind of crazy. You know, I had never eaten sushi until basically I moved to Japan, and then I realized, oh, there's this whole world of delicious food out there, as I think you do once you start to travel. And, you know, marrying into a Japanese family, I realized there was so much more than the sushi and the tempura and the things that we were eating in America that was available to cook. So I really wanted to learn all those things and then share that knowledge with my friends and family here.
And sounds like you really had a blast trying new things. You had lived in Japan prior to your marriage as well, and it sounds like you made it your mission and people went out of their way to give you interesting stuff to eat.
Well, I do like to eat a lot of different things. I grew up right outside of New York, and so we went into New York during the week, and we would eat all kinds of crazy stuff. And so when I moved to Japan, I just did that same thing. And people love, they delight in sharing their food with you, you know. And so there were all these wonderful people who shared all kinds of things with me, and I ate everything. And some of it was a little bit weird, to be sure. But then some of it I found to be a lot more familiar than I expected. You know, there's a big culture of adopting cuisines in Japan to the Japanese taste, but there's many ingredients and dishes that might seem somewhat familiar to a Western palate, and I was surprised to find that.
Yeah, what kind of things did you find? You write that, you know, Japanese food isn't this one thing fixed in time. It's trading and borrowing with lots of other cultures.
That's exactly right. You know, Japan wasn't open to the Western culture until late 1800s, so they really had a lot of time to develop their own cuisine. And then when the floodgates opened at that time, a lot of influences from other countries made their way in. For example, I don't know if you know this, but tempura is actually a Portuguese dish that the Japanese adopted to their tastes and their ingredients and made it uniquely Japanese. So when you think of tempura, you think, oh, it's Japanese food, but actually it came originally from Portugal. And then there's these wonderful places there, all these cafes that are more French than France, I think. They do everything to the 10th degree. It's really wonderful, and they can cook things like nobody's business in France or in Europe or so on, but they're taking them and they're adapting them to Japanese ingredients and tastes and palates.
I want to go back to tempura. It's a aspect of Japanese cuisine that I love, but sometimes I feel guilty about it. But reading your cookbook, I feel like, oh, maybe it's not so bad, because you point out that really, really well done Japanese tempura is not that greasy. The food does not absorb that much of the oil. So what's different there?
That's exactly right. You know, most of Japanese food, even some of the foods in this book that have those Western influences, are still retain a light and fresh mentality to them. So when you're cooking tempura, for example, you know, people are afraid of frying, like you said. People are afraid of the greasy flavor, or it might not, you know, come out right. It might be too heavy. But actually, it's a very light, thin batter that's so light you put ice cubes in it to make it really, really light. And then you fry it just so briefly at a high temperature that it doesn't have time to soak up that grease, and it's absolutely crispy and delicious. So you should not have a fear of frying.
And one tip that I love on the frying here, and this is something I failed on other forms of deep frying, don't put too much in the oil at once, because it cools down the oil, ruins everything, right? That's key?
Bingo. That makes too much stuff in the oil makes like the soggiest fry you're ever going to have, and you'll be very disappointed. So take your time, be patient. I think that's the one thing about this kind of cooking is, you know, there's really nothing you can do too far wrong. You just want to take your time. Be patient, use techniques that you already know, and then apply them to these ingredients and these methods.
We're talking with Amy Kaneko right now about her new cookbook. It's called Let's Cook Japanese Food. She's an American who spent 2 years living in Japan with her Japanese husband. And you also write about one of my favorite foods, not too many places to get it, at least that I found in Wisconsin, okonomiyaki, which is, I don't know, I should let you describe it, the pro, but I think of it as kind of a pancake.
I think you're exactly right. Some people actually call it a Japanese pizza or pancake. Pizza's not exactly right. It's not topped with cheese and sauce, but it does have that kind of aspect. It's a big round food. The thing about okonomiyaki, and okonomiyaki is just the Japanese word for as you like it, things that you like. And that's all that means. And what's so great about this recipe is its flexibility. Really, you can use any ingredients that you have on hand or that you like and mix them into this batter, and you just cook it on a nonstick frying pan or a griddle. It's super easy to accomplish in a Western kitchen. And I have to say, kids love this dish. This is, if you're going to try something in this book and you want your kids to eat it and have success, I would start here. Super easy to make.
We've got a link to a recipe for this, by the way, okonomiyaki, on the Central Time Facebook page. You can try it out at home. And as you were saying, Amy, you can put different toppings in it, different fillings. What are some of the most common things we'll see in okonomiyaki? That we should make an Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, it occurs to me, actually.
This is a Wisconsin version.
Oconomowoc Miyaki. We'll work on that. Anyway, Amy, good fillings for that.
That one has brought.
10 times fast. you know, it's actually a dish that is made of, I think, leftovers. Number one is cabbage. You're always going to have chopped cabbage in it, and that's like bulks the thing up. You're going to have eggs in it, which you're going to mix up. Your, you know, typical flour, baking powder, salt. These are all things that you will definitely have access to. I put green onions in mine because I really like green onions. I use bacon because in Japan they have this awesome, like very thinly sliced pork belly, which is a little harder to get here. If you can get that, by all means do it. So you can cook that up a little bit first before you throw it into the batter because raw bacon is not very delicious. So you do want to cook that a little bit first. You could put chicken in it. You can put shrimp in it. My kids really like shrimp and cooked squid in there. So it really runs the gamut of the ingredients.
And the sauces are kind of key to this, too. What are these sauces like on top of it?
Yes, the sauces are super key, because otherwise it's going to be a delicious pancake with all these fillings. It'll still taste really good. But I think you do want to seek out the sauces. And these are really typical sauces that will go a lot with a lot of the recipes in this book, frankly. The first one is called okonomiyaki sauce, or tonkatsu sauce is also a good substitute. And really what that is, it's like a Worcestershire-based sauce. Tastes, if you ask me, and probably if you ask a Japanese person, they'll say, what are you talking about? But it tastes to me like A1 sauce, frankly. And in a pinch, if I didn't have these sauces, I would try a little A1 sauce, because that's a very heavy Worcestershire taste. So you drizzle that over the top of your pancake. Then the other thing that you put on here is mayonnaise. And I happen to love mayonnaise on things. And it really works on this recipe, so it gives a little creamy taste. There's this brand in Japan called Kewpie Mayonnaise. And you squeeze it over. It comes in a squeeze tube, and it's really fun to work with. And each individual diner does that to their own tastes. And the other toppings that are typical include aonori. So you might be familiar with regular nori seaweed, which is the grilled seaweed that goes on the outside of the sushi roll. So This is a variation on that. It's a very bright green, blue color, and it's flaky. And it looks really pretty on top of the okonomiyaki, but it also lends like a really nice little sea taste to it. But if you can't find that, you can also use regular yakinori, just regular, you know, the sheet nori that you're used to, cutting up small. But all of these ingredients, happily, are really easily available in a lot of supermarkets these days and also online. So you can find any of these things. You know, Kikkoman makes all these sauces. They're in my local supermarket, and I live in Colorado, so it's not like a hotbed of, you know, Asian cuisine there.
You mentioned
that. So I can find all of these things.
You mentioned that mayonnaise, Amy, and you had a recipe for salmon on mayonnaise, and you said, so you mentioned that Japanese brand. You also give a little tip for turning any old mayonnaise into something like that. How can we doctor it to make it more of a Japanese mayonnaise?
You can doctor it, and I have done this when I'm in a pinch. I'll take regular old Hellman's or whatever kind of mayonnaise that you have, and I will thin it a little bit with some lemon juice or maybe even a little bit of rice vinegar, and that little extra tartness and sour taste. Don't thin it too much, but just enough to add that little bite to it. And that makes it taste more like the typical Japanese mayonnaise.
Could you mix it with something like wasabi? What would that give you?
That would give you a nose freeze. You know how you get that wasabi brain freeze? I mean, you can absolutely mix mayonnaise and wasabi, though. That tastes really good on some things. I would try that maybe on some grilled steak and have a wasabi mayonnaise on the side. Ooh. That could be really good.
Well, we're talking right now with Amy Kaneko, an American who spent years living in Japan and also with her Japanese husband. She's in the States now again and is the author of the cookbook we're talking about today. It's called Let's Cook Japanese Food.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried Japanese food at home? What tips do you have to share? Do you have Japanese heritage? Is this part of your childhood growing up? What are some of your favorite foods, some of your tips? If you've cooked it, how is Japanese home cooking different from what we find in restaurants? And if there's something that you've had at Japanese restaurants you'd like some advice on how to make at home, give a call. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post and find a couple recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation about Japanese home cooking. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite Japanese dish that you like to make? Maybe to eat out at a restaurant, you want to see if you can recreate it at home. What is the secret, do you think, to getting some of these flavors right? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Amy Kaneko is with us. She's an American home cook and a cookbook author. She spent years living in Japan and is married into a Japanese family. She learned how to cook Japanese food. She's sharing her recipes in her new book. It's called Let's Cook Japanese Food.
And let's talk about another recipe now. At least in the neck of the woods where we are in Madison, Amy, there are ramen shops popping up all over the place. It seems like it's really having a moment, at least in Wisconsin. What goes into a really delicious bowl of ramen?
Well, ramen is one of those national dishes, and it's as individual as the people who make it. And that's what's so fun about it and makes it so accessible, I think, for a home cook here in the U.S. There are lots of ramen shops everywhere, not just Wisconsin. I'm super happy to see that. So what makes it is the noodles, of course, and then the broth. And so at home, you know, you don't have the hours to cook the pork bones and the chicken bones and so on. I really use chicken broth, but I really spice it up with some of those really unique flavors that work really well in ramen, like a chili bean paste, which is like has a little garlic in it, a little hot red pepper, a little bit of oil, and then, of course, garlic. I use chicken broth in mine, sesame seeds. Those are all really great tastes to put into your ramen.
We've got a link to the special pork and sesame ramen noodle soup on the Central Time Facebook page. You have one of the best cooking instructions I've seen in a cookbook, Amy, when you're getting ready to make the ramen. Discard the flavor packets from the ramen packages. Because those,
yes.
I used to eat this, I mean, you know, 10 cents a packet or something back
right.
in the day for ramen. Those flavor packets were really kind of gross when I look back on it.
They are really kind of gross. They are pretty salty, and, you know, you can make your own flavor packet, I think, much nicer than those. But the noodles, on the other hand, especially if you live somewhere where it's difficult to get the fresh noodles, are totally usable in the home version of ramen. So throw that packet out and take the ramen noodles themselves and just boil them up really quick. But watch them, because you don't want to overboil them. You don't want them mushy. You know,
yeah.
The texture of the noodle is still really important.
And walk us through this particular recipe, if you would, Amy. And what if you are throwing out that flavor packet? What are you putting in instead?
Well, first of all, I have to call out, this is my husband's special pork ramen. His name is Shohei. And Japanese husbands are not famous for cooking at home, but they usually have three or four dishes that they cook to perfection, and ramen is one of them. So this is his recipe. And his special taste is he likes to put sesame oil in there. Chicken broth is the base, because that's what we can get. It's very easy, and we just use chicken broth. You can use homemade or canned. Put a little sesame oil, a little bit of that chili bean paste, which, again, is like a... it's like a spicy, garlicky, but not too spicy, red pepper sauce. And I found that at local supermarkets. Again, you can order that online. Definitely add some garlic. If you're a garlic lover, add a lot. If you're not, just add a little bit. You could put some ginger in there, some ground ginger. You could put a green onions, definitely green onions in there. And that's what's going to flavor your broth in a way that is fresher and more delicious, frankly, than what you're going to get in the packet.
And this is a beautiful-looking recipe as pictured in your cookbook. And I wanted to ask, do these recipes look so good because they're in a cookbook, or is it common in Japanese food to, you know, it's not just tasty, but it's meant to be a visual treat, too?
It is meant to be a visual treat. Japan is very famous for doing things to a beautiful design sense. You know, everything has a really great... aesthetic to it, including the food. However, I am just a home cook, so the person who cooked and styled this for the cookbook has far more skills than I do, and she did an absolutely beautiful job there. It doesn't matter how it looks. I'm telling you that. I'm giving you an out right now.
Thank you.
You just want it to taste good. That is the number one thing, and then you can work on prettying it up later.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Jeff joining us from Pelican Lake. Jeff, hi.
Oh, hi.
Hi,
I just turned on the radio and I heard you talking about Japanese food, so I was going, well, that's right up my alley.
What do you want to share?
I'm the third generation Japanese. My parents were born in Los Angeles area, and then they moved to the Milwaukee area, and now I'm retired and I live up north at Pelican Lake. And my favorite dish or flavor is the teriyaki. So it's usually teriyaki chicken, or it can be beef or salmon.
Right. That's right. Teriyaki is so popular and so easy to achieve at home. Do you cook it at home, Jeff?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I just finished my last piece of chicken teriyaki. I like to use a thigh.
He's eating it as we speak.
Well, it's a good picnic food, and once you cook up a batch, you can just put it aside, you know, in the refrigerator and just take it out, you know, as just warm it up a little bit. Or, you know, you can eat it cold, too.
So, Jeff, do you make your own teriyaki sauce?
Yes.
What goes into yours?
Well, ginger, garlic, I have to substitute for, like, rice wine because it's hard to find sake up here, you know, so
that
we put
sense.
Sherry in or something like that, and I think it passes, you know, it's pretty good, and of course there's a lot of sugar in it and soy sauce, or as I call it, shoyu, you know, and, it's easy to make, and some of the recipes for chicken teriyaki, you have to marinate them, like, overnight, and they're better. I've gotten to the point where I just thaw the chicken thighs out, and then I put them in a big kettle, and I put the sauce in there to cover, and then I just simmer it on top of the stove for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and then I take it out and I finish it in the oven.
Oh, wow, that's a unique way of doing it. That sounds really good.
It's really fast, you know, because then all you do is you do your sauces and everything goes in the same pot. You don't have to have a separate bowl. The sugar dissolves in the heat right away. And then you just simmer it, and then the house smells great.
Wow. You can tell Jeff is an expert at this. How does that stack up to how you've been preparing it, Amy? Is this one of those things where the individual cook puts their own spin on how they do teriyaki?
They kind of do. You know, teriyaki is exactly what Jeff said. It is that basic triumvirate of flavors, the sake, the sugar, and the shoyu, the soy sauce, as we just said. And you can use as much sweetness or as little as you like. You know, my husband, for example, likes it less sweet, so I don't use as much sugar when I'm cooking it and he's going to be eating it. But when the kids are eating it, I definitely do up the sweetness. One of the things that you might want to look for, Jeff, is, you know, ordering online or something, the mirin, which is a sweetened cooking wine. And that adds some sweetness, but without the real sugary overload taste. It helps caramelize your sauce even more, your teriyaki sauce. And a caramelized teriyaki sauce is exactly what you're going for. But it sounds like your method would work really well.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. We're talking to Amy Kaneko. Her new cookbook is Let's Cook Japanese Food. Staying with that teriyaki, I'm looking at your salmon teriyaki recipe, and you say Americans maybe misunderstand this. It shouldn't be a swamp of teriyaki sauce. It's a glaze. A little bit goes a long way, you're saying.
That's correct. And if you know, the picture in my book will show you how the sauce caramelizes down, and it becomes really thickened up, and then that becomes a really nice glaze over the fish or the chicken. So you're not eating big, you know, dollops of sauce. You're just tasting this beautiful, sweet, caramelized shoyu taste. So good.
I wonder if we can talk about something really basic, but that can be hard to get perfectly right. What about cooking rice and getting it so it's not burned at the bottoms? It's something that you doesn't get crusty, but it is cooked all the way. Do you have any recommendations there, Amy?
Well, I've been there many times with the crusty rice on the bottom of the pan. If I am cooking it on the stovetop, I use a nonstick pot because I'm really aware of the sticking on the bottom. To be very, very honest with you, I haven't cooked rice in a pot in a really long time because I just went online and got myself a rice cooker. You can get them for like $20, and that was the best $20 I ever spent, seriously, because it cooks it to perfection. It kind of steams it for you at the right temperature. It won't stick, and then it will sit and hold for you at that temperature, which makes life much easier. But if you cook it, there is a recipe for cooking it in a pot. And here, again, I would recommend the nonstick. And it's about the proportion of the water to the rice and letting it steam without lifting up that lid and peeking.
That sounds fantastic. I'm pretty good with a stovetop rice cooking, but we do have a rice cooker in the house for my wife to use. Amy, leave us with some encouragement if we're still daunted by the concept of home Japanese cooking. Talk us into it.
Well, I don't want you to be daunted. That was my whole point in writing this book, is because I realized there was a whole wealth of cuisine that we didn't know here in the U.S. and that people were needlessly intimidated by it, because really the ingredients and the methods are quite similar to what you already cook with, just used in a different way. So, for example, the tonkatsu, which is a fried pork cutlet, very, very easy to do. If you've ever fried any kind of cutlet at all, this is just using a different type of breadcrumbs and adding the right sauce on top. I'm a home cook. I'm not a chef, you know, but I can turn out these beautiful Japanese meals in the same time that it takes me to cook a regular meal during the week. And I think if you try these recipes, you'll find that you can too.
We'll leave it there for now. Amy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Arigatou gozaimasu.
And goodbye to you as well. That's Amy Kaneko, author of Let's Cook Japanese Food, and talking about how to cook authentic homestyle Japanese dishes. Now, we have two of her recipes on the Central Time Facebook page, Shohei's special pork and sesame ramen noodle soup, and then
Okonomiyaki.
I'm help you out there. Yeah, I had it the first time, and then I lost it. And I really want someone in Economy Walk to make some okonomiyaki. Right, so go online, find that recipe, and take a picture of it and send it to us. This needs to happen. Maybe go to the Welcome to Oconomowoc sign.
This is a tongue twister. Oconomowoc Okonomiyaki.
Oconomowoc Okonomiyaki.
There you go.
We can say it. You can do it. And if you if you make any of these recipes, let us know. We'd love to see how it turns out. Anything you're looking to try this weekend?
I'm actually seriously considering. I've never made my own Okonomiyaki, and there's this beautiful
recipe.
Love this stuff. I do love it. My kids love it. It's delicious. It doesn't seem like it's hard to make based on the book. So yeah, it's a perfect chilly Wisconsin weather kind of meal. Looks good. This is Central Time. We saw a story from across the pond and a big new trend there. We're wondering if the same trend is happening here in the United States. Rob, what is this trend?
Cat ownership in the UK is up, way up, like 500,000 more pet cats than the previous year. This according to a survey from the Pet Food Manufacturers Association. They care. They're interested in this sort of statistic.
They're vested. And the increase is driven largely by men. 17% of men in the UK are now cat owners. This is up from 13% in the previous year. The survey's author suggests that celebrity cat owners like actor Russell Brand, singer Ed Sheeran, may be helping to drive this new cat-tastic trend.
So we ask you, is this happening here? Are more men becoming cat people? Dudes out there, have you gotten a cat over the last year?
Cat tweet, or two or three.
Or three, yeah. Send us a tweet. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or message us on the Central Time Facebook page. Maybe this is all about online cat pictures.
It could be. It could be. It seems like a new thing, though. And, Rob, you're kind of a cat guy.
I've had cats in the past. We do not currently have ones. We just got some new furniture, so maybe no. And we've been waiting,
you know,
in part because of cats
I'm
and kids.
I'm going to say a lot of cat owners also have furniture.
Yeah. Yeah, weird. The two just really don't mix.
We'll see.
I speak from bitter experience.
Well, let us know if you're a guy, you just got a cat. Tell us why. Show us a picture of that cat on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to the Ideas Network.